I've been drafted today to tell you about microscopic aspects of insulating rare earth polymer magnets, or sort of in short, to make sure we have sort of a common footing to go from the sort of F electron physics all the way to these nice effective spin models, which we're mostly going to be talking about today. Today, tomorrow, and the next day. Good. So again, this needs no real introduction. You know, quantum spin ice is defined on the power core lattice of corner sharing tetrahedra, one of the canonical 3D frustrated lattices. This is realized for most of the systems of interest in these power core oxides, or more recently in these power core spinels, where the magnetic ion of interest is this rare earth ion R. And these are all strong insulators. So what I want to cover today is sort of aspects of rare earth magnetism, how to go from the microscopics to the sort of low energy physics. So why rare earths to begin with? So this sort of lanthanide series of 4F, partially filled 4F shells, is a very rich sort of resource for magnetic systems. So you get this full slate of magnetic ions that are very chemically similar, only really differ in magnetic properties, you know, aside from a few, you know, exceptions that aren't magnetic. And so what makes these so nice for magnetic materials is there's a nice, clean separation of energy scales. Mostly there are exceptions. So what I mean by that is the atomic Kalman interactions are much, much bigger than spin orbit, which are much, much bigger than the crystal field, which are much, much bigger than the exchange interactions. So typically, here we're talking the largest Coulomb kind of interactions of order of 10 EV, spin orbits of order of an EV, crystal field maybe 100 MeV, exchange another few orders of magnitude down. So unlike in, for example, some transition metals where, you know, one or all of these can be quite comparable, this you get very well-defined sort of almost atomic-like localized moments. Okay, so what does 3-ion look like here? What is the Coulomb interaction in spin orbit pick out, right? So this is sort of textbook atomic physics, right? What one has to keep in mind, though, is a few aspects of it here. First, that there are many, many states. So if you think about, for example, the electronic configuration of dysprosium, which is 4F9, 9 electrons here, so the number of relevant states is on the order of a few thousand. So these are sort of, even though they're, you know, atomic systems, they're quite complicated. Okay, so let's work our way down one energy scale. So first energy scale that resolves is Coulomb, right? This picks out, you know, regular via regular Hund's rules. You maximize X, maximize L, then either max or minimize J. And that picks out L equal 5, spin 5 half, then spin orbit, then gives you the largest J in this case, which is 15 half. So you can do this for any of the series, and sort of generically what you end up with is large J's. It's, you know, either 0 or, you know, never smaller than 2.5, and then go all the way up to 8, and usually a large orbital component. So not just spin for most of them. So these kind of J manifolds where we're talking about total angular momentum, right? So J 15 half, J 8, J have a large number of degrees of freedom. So normally we think of a spin, we think of a local moment as having a dipole moment, right? But when the angular momentum is large, you have much, much more than that. So generically, you'll have these higher multipole moments. So here, these JM states are the states of the J manifold, and this is just some notation for a multipole moment, where this K is the sort of order of it, and this Q is sort of what it does to the JZ projection. So I'll call this K the rank of the multiple. So a kth order multiple will be a rank K multiple will be a kth order polynomial in J. And so for a J manifold with you will have up to rank 2J of these. So when J is 15 half, there's up to rank 15 multiples. So the low order examples are familiar. Rank 1 is the familiar dipoles, just the J operators. Rank 2 are things like this, sort of quadrupoles. Rank 3, octupoles. Rank 4, hexadecapoles. Once you get past rank 5, I think you run out of names. Rank 6, you know, something like this. But in these systems, you can go all the way up to rank 16. So there's really a sort of a lot of stuff happening even inside just one of these J manifolds. Okay, so we resolved Coulomb, we resolved spin orbit. Now, on top of that, we then have the crystal field as the next largest energy scale. And so what this does is this splits these J states. So this 2J plus 1 degeneracy is lifted by the crystal, the electric fields from the surrounding ions in the crystal. For the pyrochlore lattice of interest, this is strongly constrained by symmetry. So this is sort of necessarily D3D for a pyrochlore lattice. I've illustrated the sort of local environment here for the rare earth pyrochlore oxides. The spinels, this sort of oxygen environment's different, or the ligand environment is different, but the symmetry is still the same. And so what you have is you have sort of three relevant operations. One, you have a C3 rotation going in or out of the two neighboring tetrahedra. You have a C2 operation in a plane perpendicular to that. And then you have an inversion about the site center. So usually we define our local coordinate system so that Z is along this C3 axis and Y is along this C2. So for this symmetry, this will take one of these J manifolds and knock it down to either a singlet or a doublet. So again, this seems familiar. I'm expecting about 80% of this to be familiar to all of you, but I'm hoping it's not the same 80%. So this kind of crystal field potential can be characterized in terms of these kind of multiple operators. You know, you write down the electric potential and you project it into this J manifold and you get some kind of effective description like that. These crystal field parameters are strongly material dependent. So these have to be determined, you know, basically in every single material case. And typically, as I said before, you end up with splittings on the order from anywhere from 10 MeV to 100 MeV. Some exceptional cases can even be quite a bit smaller. Okay, so now we resolve crystal field, we end up with a singlet or a doublet. What kind of states can we get? So generically, there's three kinds of states. They can be classified by the irreducible representations of this site symmetry. So I'm going to distinguish two cases here, Cramer's, where you have an odd number of electrons, non-Cramer's, where you have an even number. So for Cramer's, there's two possibilities. This gamma 4 irreducible representation I'm going to call pseudo-spin doublet. This gamma 5, 6 I'm going to call dipolar octopolar. For non-Cramer's, you also have two possibilities, one of which we don't care about. So you can have a singlet. We'll forget that case, non-magnetic. Or you can have a doublet, which I'll just call a non-Cramer's doublet. Okay, so because the sort of trickiest one is this dipolar octopolar one, I'll sort of go through these in a permuted order. We'll start with pseudospin, which is the simplest, then do non-Cramer's, then do dipolar octopolar. Okay, what is a pseudospin doublet? So this is sort of the one where if you just sort of close your eyes and don't think very hard, it looks a lot like a spin a half. The degeneracy here is protected by time reversal because of it's a Cramer's ion, and it involves states that are sort of connected to plus minus a half. So because of the C3 symmetry, these differ by sort of multiples of 3 units of angular momentum. And most of the discussion we'll talk about are in terms of pseudo-spin operators of this doublet. So we'll construct some SX, SY, SZ operators, which I've written here. So for this case, all three of these behave just like magnetic dipoles. So the SZ will behave like a magnetic dipole pointing in this local Z direction, SY like a magnetic dipole in the local Y, SX in the local X. And so because of this symmetry, how these magnetic dipoles relate to the total physical dipole, there's two G factors, one for these in-plane components, one for the out-of-plane components. And so if you just think of this one single ion property, you can have two kinds of order. One kind of order, really, you know. If this SZ is non-zero, you have some kind of, you have a dipole along Z. Here, you just have an in-plane dipole. Both of them break time reversal. And so with respect to the symmetries of D3D, this behaves exactly like a regular spin-half object. Okay. So the non-Cramer's doublet is a little more exotic, but mostly familiar. So here it happens for even number of electrons, which means even J. And so these states have integral angular momentum. And here what you have is, you know, states that are connected by units of plus minus 3 to states like plus minus 4, plus minus 1. And so here the degeneracy of the doublet is only protected by the spatial symmetries. And it can be lifted without breaking time reversal. So this is what makes it non-Cramer's. And because of this, you end up with very strongly anisotropic properties. So the Z component of this behaves like a magnetic dipole along the local Z, but the in-plane components of the spin behave like electric quadrupoles. So I've sort of tried to illustrate this here. This should look like an XZ or a YZ D orbital. So it has an orientation and a direction to it, but it doesn't break time reversal or inversion. That's what this poorly drawn cartoon is supposed to say. And so because of this, because these are quadrupoles and they're time reversal even, the magnetic dipole moment is only determined by SZ. Okay, so the weirdest case is this last one, the gamma 5-6 doublet, which is dipolar octopolar. So here, the states are, the degeneracy is protected by Cramer's theorem, but the states are not related by spatial symmetries. So for spin half, for the pseudo spin half doublet, you can connect the states both by time reversal or by doing some C2 rotation, for example. Here, they're only connected by time reversal. And so generically, this is sort of connected by multiples of plus minus 3 angular momentum to these plus minus 3 half states. And so you can kind of see why they're a little funny here, right? So if you try rotating a plus minus 3 half state by a C3 rotation, right, you'll have e to the I 2 pi by 3. It'll just be 1. So they're actually invariant under those C3 rotations. And so this holds true for all of the operations, actually, for an appropriate choice of basis. So the subtlety here is that the X and the Z components of this guy actually transform in the same way. So just like before, the Z component of the pseudospin, if you pick the canonical basis, transforms like a magnetic dipole along local Z. But now the X component also transforms like a magnetic dipole along local Z. So in principle, you can imagine making arbitrary combinations of that contribute to this dipole. So the conventional choice is we'll pick that to be Z, but one could easily pick that to be X. That's just a choice of basis. Now, what's left over is SY. So if this pseudospin is oriented in the local Y direction, then it's an octopole moment. So this statement that these guys are essentially not connected by spatial symmetry manifests in that this SY operator is invariant under all of the spatial symmetries of the site. So if you had a non-zero expectation value of this guy, you'd only break time reversal. Not a C3 rotation, not a C2 rotation, just time reversal. So it's kind of an odd kind of order parameter.
Question. How do you decide what's X and Y?
It's a choice of basis.
So everything's going to be in the plane perpendicular to C3 with that property and orthogonal one.
So the SX here also is like a dipole in the Z direction. So they behave exactly the same way. Really, this XYZ labeling is really bad labeling, in a sense. This should be, X should be Z1 and Z should be Z2 and then Y should be something else entirely, right? But if you want to make it look like a spin half, we label it by XYZ.
But there's a particular direction in the plane perpendicular to the three-fold axis that you call X.
Hmm? Yeah, but that has no relation to SX in this case. So the only way, so in the previous cases, so for example, the pseudospin doublet, for example, in physical quantities, SX showed up with that local direction. That's how they got connected. Here, it's not connected at all to local X. That's why this is, in some sense, bad notation. And why it's a little confusing. So the Z here, the SX operator in this case is not related to the local X axis. That's yeah. So it's
in some sense they're both dipoles
along local Z. And you can draw a picture of it. I did not try to. I left you with a question mark. You can try to imagine an F orbital that has this property. Something like the z cubed orbital, I think, is about right, but I didn't want to try to draw it. Okay, so those are the three orbitals. I just want to make a sort of side comment about multiples here. So I said these guys have all these multiple moments. So how does this manifest in the low energy physics in these spin states? statement to make here is when I project these multiples, they drop down into these spin operators plus constants, which I've left out. So what I want to emphasize is that any multiple can contribute to any effective spin so long as they have the same symmetry. So when this pseudospin, you know, I said it has a magnetic dipole in this direction, but it also has higher magnetic multipole moments. So it carries magnetic octopole moments, magnetic et cetera, that transform the same way under symmetry. So similarly, for the dipolar octopolar, the dipole-like parts also carry higher moments. Y carries octopole and higher. And for non-Kramers, you know, the quadrupolar parts also carry hexadecapole and higher moments. So when I say dipole or quadrupole, that's the minimum, in a sense, that it transforms like. It can always have higher because we've removed all of the spatial symmetry. Okay, so this is the single ion physics. This is just a sort of summary of it, how these guys behave under symmetries. Pseudospin, dipolar, octopolar, non-Kramers. So these show up in, you know, the pseudospin shows up in this, you know, for example, erbium titanate, ytterbium titanate, the dipolar octopolar dysprosium titanate, some neodymium compounds, and non-Kramers, for example, holmium titanate, terbium titanate. Okay, that is one ion physics. Two ion physics. So now we know what our degrees of freedom are. How do they interact? So let's go back to the pyrochlore lattice. If you stare at this and think about the symmetries of this thing, you'll see that there are sort of three types of bonds, which I've labeled red, X, Y, and Z here, colored red, green, and blue. And the exchange interactions allowed between these atoms is strongly constrained by the symmetries of these bonds. So if you focus on just one bond, there are sort of three relevant symmetries. So if this is the, get as much use out of this hockey stick as possible. If this is the bond, then there's a C2 axis perpendicular. So this would be along one of the qubit directions. There's a reflection in the plane perpendicular to the bond. Then there's a reflection in the bond. And then so that constrains the one bond. Then the others are just related by C3 rotations. So if you sit down and act reflections on spins for these three cases, it turns out you can encapsulate this in sort of all the same form. So this is sort of the general anisotropic exchange model for these doublets. In the most general case, there's four couplings. There's the Ising coupling, which on its own would just give you classical spin ice. There's an XY coupling here. There's these anisotropic couplings with bond-dependent phases. So in all cases, this phase is directly related to that one. And then we can distinguish the three kinds of doublets basically by setting these phases. So for a pseudospin, for the different X, Y, and Z bonds, we set these guys to be the three third roots of unity. We do the same thing for non-Kramers, except now because the Z is a dipole, or is time reversal odd, and then the X, Y are time reversal even, this Z plus minus coupling vanishes. Then for dipolar octopolar, because they basically don't change under symmetry operations, these phases are constants. So we can just set this gamma to 1. And so the quantum spin ice we're looking for will be when we have this guy, it's dominant and it's positive. Okay, so where does this come from? What is the microscopic origin of this? So here's the way I want to sort of present this. It's going to sort of jump around in energy scale a bit, so I wanted to outline it somewhat. So there's sort of three levels of description I want to talk about here. One is the sort of bare electronic level, where we're talking about how these F electrons move around, what their atomic interactions are. Then projecting into this J manifold, which is the free ion ground state, so these F operators map to these multipoles, we get some interactions between multipoles with some crystal field interaction. Then resolving the crystal field interaction, these multipoles turn into these pseudospins. And so we go from this theory of interacting multipoles to this anisotropic exchange model that I just showed you. So to derive the microscopics, this guy is really unwieldy, given the amount of F electron states we're talking about. This guy depends on the details of the crystal field Hamiltonian, which vary strongly from material to material. This guy, these vary strongly from material to material, but this description is sort of generic to the given rare earth ion. So it's sort of a nice intermediate place in between these two descriptions to think about the problem. Okay, so what are these multipolar interactions? So in general, you expect all of these to interact, right? If I have some degrees of freedom on this side and they carry all these multipole moments, they can interact with all the other multipole moments that are that'll permit it by symmetry. You could sit down and do the same analysis of the reflections and the C2 rotations that we did for the pseudospins for these multipoles as well, except it would take a very long time and it wouldn't be very helpful. Basically, even for moderate J's, you can have tens to hundreds of these couplings that are allowed by symmetry. Right? Just think, this. Suppose I have J is 6, right? Then I have up to rank 12 multipoles, right? And so these K's run from 1 to 12, and then these Q's run from minus 6 to 6. So this is a very large coupling matrix. So what I want to ask, and I want to sort of try to partially answer, is first, what generates this? What kind of mechanisms are we talking about? And two, given that this is a terrible, complicated mess, is there anything useful we can learn about it without looking at the details? Okay, so there's all sorts of mechanisms one can have. I've outlined a few of them here. I've sort of highlighted the ones I'll discuss in some amount of detail. So there's regular magneto and electrostatic interactions between these multipoles. There's direct exchange, super exchange through the ligands, exchange, super exchange through higher orbitals, exchange where you go through the higher orbitals that involve intershell interactions, magneto-elastic couplings, virtual crystal field, which is sort of outside of this, but I'll come back to it. And all of these, you know, add up and they compete with each other. They all have small energy scales, and they're all complicated. So making this quantitative is difficult. I just want to give you a flavor for what these look like. These guys, at least, we can say make quantitative statements. These guys, we can make qualitative arguments. So of the magneto and electrostatic interactions, only two are relevant, which are sort of the two lowest ones for each sector. So in principle, because these multiples can go to high rank, you can have all the way up to high rank interactions, but those coupling constants decay very quickly, both as a function of distance and as a function of rank. So it turns out only the lowest magnetic dipole-dipole interaction will be significant, and so in some compounds with very large moments, this is the most significant interaction. And in some non-Cramer's compounds, this electric quadrupole interaction can also be significant. But this is only relevant for non-Cramers, right? So these Q operators or quadrupoles, when you project them into these pseudospins, they have to be time reversal even, right? So for any of the pseudospin or the dipolar or octopolar cases, this guy just doesn't contribute. But the scale can be non-trivial, depending on the size of the quadrupole moment of the atom. Okay, but these are nice, and then you can just write down the coupling constants. Magnetostatics, and I didn't write this one down, but it's, you know, similar in spirit of E squared over 4 pi epsilon naughts. Okay, more complicated is super exchange. So to give you some idea of why this is complicated, let me just sort of sketch what a charge transfer process might involve for these things. So if you're going to have super exchange, you want to shuttle an electron back and forth between the two ions. So whether this goes through a ligand or directly, I'm not going to specify. But in between, you're going to get these charge states, you know, off by one from the original. Now, as for the original freon states, these virtual states that are involved in this transfer process have a very complicated spectrum, and there's a very large number of them. So just like the ground state manifold itself was a few thousand states, for example, for terbium 4 plus, where it's F7, you have about 3,000 states. For terbium 2 plus, where it's F9, you have about 2,000 states. So these are all virtual states that go into this perturbative process to generate super exchange. And as you can see, even with just free ion atomic interactions, it's a wide and dense and complicated spectrum. So let me make this go back to a simpler case that everybody should be familiar with, right? If you think about what it looks like for a Hubbard model, one-band Hubbard model, it's very, very simple, right? You have some hopping and some on-site repulsion. And then at second order, this virtual process generates an anti-ferromagnetic exchange interaction. But here we only have one intermediate state with energy of order U. And the hopping, and there's only one hopping. So in the F orbital case, you can make a similar argument as a sort of simplified picture, where you say, well, let's integrate out everything but the F electrons and have these guys be able to transfer electrons back and forth. And let's have the full atomic interaction, these free ion atomic interactions. And then let's do our second order perturbation theory. So if you do this properly, you include this spectrum I just showed you with the terrible mess. For a qualitative picture, let's replace that whole spectrum with just one. We just put all those states at one energy level. So we just say that cost of energy to transfer the charge is dominant, just like in the single band Hubbard case, and we forget everything else. So then you get a very similar result. So you have something that looks like T squared over U. You have something that looked like these operators that end up being these spin operators in the Hubbard case. But now you have a sort of messy orbital dependence because of the many orbitals of the F shell. Okay, so if you stare at these guys for a minute, you realize that they're not entirely generic. So this operator has a special form where it's bilinear in these F electron creation annihilation operators. So it actually puts a microscopic constraint on the multipolar content of super exchange interactions. So the simplest way to think about it is, in this process, I'm going to be hopping an electron from one rare earth to another and then back, right? So along the way, I'm going to involve the atomic states and then in these hopping intervals. So to a very good approximation, the atomic states are spherically symmetric, so they can't change the angular momentum, but the hoppings are not. But because we're only moving one electron, at most you can transfer 3 units of orbital angular momentum and half a unit of spin angular momentum per hop. So going once and back, you can transfer at most 7 units of total angular momentum. And so this argument survives this sort of Hubbard-like approximation I made. And it's actually true quite generally that even though you would expect to have the full slate of multiple interactions, you can actually cut these off at rank 7. So 7 is still very high, right? We ran out of names at 5. But for some atoms, it's much, much less than the full. So for example, this can give you sort of non-trivial constraints. So for these sort of classical spin ices, dysprosium and holmium titanate, where the J's are very large and the crystal field ground doublets are almost maximal weight in the largest JZ component, then to flip this spin, you have to impart 15 units of angular momentum to this guy, 16 units to this guy. So this is just not possible with multiples of rank 7 or lower. And so what that means is super exchange is not going to generate spin flip operators. And so your interactions are going to remain mostly classical. So sort of an example on the other end of the spectrum, if you think about a terbium, where J is 7/2, all the operators have rank less than 7, less than or equal to 7. So you can get everything. So this argument tells you nothing. So it can be helpful, it can be not helpful. Here you should expect, it's not clear that one should expect any clear limiting regime for something like a terbium. Nope.
Did you say what you mean by, is it spin flip is almost classical, nearly classical? What do you mean by?
Right, so, yeah, we're talking about operators like this. So these are the operators that are gonna be interacting, right? And these will project down to some multiple. Right? And then those multiples will project down to some effective spin 1/2, right? So if there's no transverse parts to the spins, if it's only SZ, then it's classical. And what I'm saying is those spin flip operators for these kinds of doublets basically have to be like J minus to the power of 15, which is a rank 15 operator. So those aren't going to show up from super exchange. So what that means is this effective Hamiltonian, many slides back, everything but this first term is going to be gone at this leading order of approximation. Okay, so summary of the two-ion physics. So you have these high-rank multiple interactions. You don't get the full set. You stop at 7, but 7 is still a pretty big number. And sometimes that can let you make statements about the effective model, not always. And so some things I want to take away, some sort of implications of this, is that because all these multiples all contribute to the same pseudospins, the single ion and the two ion physics are not necessarily related, right? Ising-like moments does not imply Ising interactions. XY-like moments does not imply XY-like interactions, because these multiples all contribute. Further, because you have all these multiples, the interactions is not bilinear. So no J dot J, no, the interaction between the effective spins is bilinear, because there's nothing else you can write down. But between the J's, this is not a good approximation. Okay, I still have 1 minute or so. Yeah. So this is one caveat at the end here, which I said I'd mention, is virtual crystal field interactions. So this is another source of interactions between the rare earth ions, but it's sort of separate from the others. So in this whole process, we've assumed that this separation of energy scales has been in some sense perfect, right? That I can go from this level of description, project down to the next one, this level, project down to the next one, right? In reality, it's not perfect. These scales are large, but finite. So if these aren't that large, then really you should go past first order and degenerate perturbation theory, go to second order, go to third order, et cetera, et cetera. So these virtual crystal, this is not usually a problem for that first step of description. Going from the sort of electronic Coulomb physics to the J's, but it's very, there are plenty of examples where the crystal field energy scale is not that much bigger than the exchange energy scale. So for example, terbium titanate, the crystal field gap is only a few MeV. Erbium titanate's a little higher, but again, not that much higher. So here you would treat these multiple interactions, they wouldn't just be projected into the crystal field ground state, but they'd be a perturbation on top of the crystal field Hamiltonian. And so at this point, you know, everything is possible. So there's basically no constraints on what can be generated that way. So you lose basically all control when the crystal field energy scale is small. Okay, so that's sort of the summary. I think that's all the information needed for everything else. And so I'll just leave that up and stop there.
Before we take questions, I'd like to make two comments. First of all, if you have clarification questions, like is it an X or an Y, please ask them. But more technical questions, leave them to the end, because the talks are being recorded. And so it would be nice that the mic gets passed around and the questions can be heard on the taping as well as the answer. And so again, if you, I know you went a bit fast, but don't worry, it's all going to be on
Did I end early?
That's good.
Okay.
So all the talks are recorded unless you don't want your talk being recorded, please let me know so it won't happen. Okay. Where's Mike?
I don't know. I just have hockey stick.
Okay. Yes, Bruce.
This may be a dumb question, but you're talking about the capacity of super exchange to flip the spin in the case where they're high rank. And so can you say a bit about the capacity of a neutron, I have a very personal perspective, the capacity of a neutron to flip the appropriate spin, given that it's dipole operators and such?
Okay, so this can be subtle. It depends on the case. So for the pseudospin doublet, it's not subtle. It's fine. For the dipolar octopolar doublet, which is what dysprosium is an example of, it can be a little bit subtle because this SX can flip the pseudospin as well. And so there's something I kind of glossed over here, which but is important if you want to look at the detail of these dipolar octopolar systems, which is if you set these phases to one, then you can rewrite this a little more simply as a ZZ coupling, an XX coupling, a YY coupling, and then a coupling between X, a symmetric coupling between X and Z. Right? And so one way to simplify that, since there's no bond dependence anymore, is to rotate away that XZ coupling. And so that makes it just an XYZ type model. But when you do that, you mix in, it affects the definition of the moment. So coming back to what you asked, if you did that rotation, this would have some linear combination of X and Z. And so you really, to describe the low energy details of the system, for example, in spin ice, you sort of want to do this rotation. And so depending on how big that symmetric XZ coupling term is, you'll mix in a little bit of, so if it's small, you'll mix in a little bit of SX into this. And so in principle, I think you could measure a spin flip with neutron, which couples to this moment, if that's large enough. For non-Kramers, I'd say no. So here, spin flips are quadrupoles. So at that level, it does not couple.
And so appropriately, so holmium titanate, for example,
yeah.
There's no inelastics.
Yeah, so here, yeah. It's really the dipolar octopolar case that's the complicated.
Could you say a word about, so because here you're talking about the singularion, about the two-body interactions.
Yeah.
Could you say about other energy scales, such as second or third nearest neighbor, with further degrees? Three or four body.
Okay, so let me start with, I don't have a good answer to that question, but I'll I'm just going to talk for a bit and then see what comes out. Okay, so the reason why it's, I think, a little subtle for second neighbor is they're in some sense not determined by the same physics. Where did Yeah, no, it's just cut off on my screen, so I can't see the whole. So if you think about exchange between these two ions, right? At the nearest neighbor level, you go from the F to the P to the F and then back again, right? So it's primarily determined by the overlap of the F and the P, right? Now, suppose I want to do second neighbor, which would be these two. Now, I think the shortest route would probably be to go through two oxygens, right? So now you have a F to P to P to F. And so there's this additional energy scale, the hopping between the P orbitals that comes in. So it's not clear that there's a definite relation between, I would expect it to be significantly smaller, but it's not clear that it has to be sort of parametrically smaller, you know, some higher power of that. For the three or four body, it's a little bit, so I would say, you know, the kind of ring exchange terms in the Hubbard model kind of sense should be very small. If you, you know, I won't try to, you know, do arithmetic up here, but if you eyeball numbers for, where did it go? These atomic scales and for these T's, you know, looking at T to the 4 over U cubed does not look promising. But the virtual crystal field can affect this a little bit. So this is something I didn't mention, there's a board here. Yeah. You can actually generate three-body interactions from virtual crystal field for the non-Kramers case. So at second order. So you can think of operators like that that are allowed by symmetry. These are time odd, even, right? Those can be generated by virtual crystal field interactions, for example. That's the only reasonable way I know to generate more than two spin in these systems. Maybe magnetoelastic as well.
If for low-lying crystal fields, these can be large. Right?
Yeah.
If they're generated by...
Or, yeah, significant. Systems. They can be significant for... Yeah.
What is the effect of virtual transition to excited outlets, the Hamiltonian material?
That's what I've been calling virtual crystal field interactions. So it'll generate corrections to all these. So it'll do lots of things. So it'll can generate all four of these terms, so you'll get corrections to these. You can generate further neighbor couplings as well in the same way. Again, this is why it's a little bit difficult to say something about further neighbor couplings, because you have multiple sort of additive contributions. And then for non-Kramers, you can also have three-spin interactions generated. The takeaway from the virtual crystal field slide is that they make everything much more complicated.
So continuing on from that, so in the case with the lowest excited crystal field levels turned in titanate,
yeah,
at low temperature it also develops dispersion, right? So
yeah,
does that play into these sorts of things?
Right. So this is I'm sort of clutching at this separation of energy scales as hard as I can for something like terbium titanate. But in reality, you probably should describe both doublets at the same, like the low energy physics is the best description, probably describe both doublets, not just the lowest. I would say that's that might be necessary. Whether it's actually necessary is a question. But given the low energy scale, it's not a priori clear that one can actually just restrict to that ground doublet. So if you describe both of them, then it's easier to see how that might acquire dispersion, for example, if it's sort of in the low energy description.
How this description will be effective if you have mixing between the multiplets now, because it's...
Oh, the Freon multiplets?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. That would be like its own version of virtual crystal field corrections. I've ignored that completely. But yes, that would also be a... So for some, on the far ends, that can be important. So for cerium and praseodymium, there's a non-trivial amount of mixing.
Which one? I didn't hear.
The light cerium and praseodymium, I think, are the ones that have the smallest separation between their freon multiplets. There's a picture. So it's, well, I can see it, but you guys probably can't see it. So, for example, for dysprosium, that's the multiplet, and then the next one is up here. And then past that, they're all mixed, right? And so ytterbium, it's these two. And then you look at cerium, and I don't know where to put the line between them. And same for praseodymium, right? But the rest of them have a pretty clear gap. Well, holmium looks a bit fuzzy now that I'm looking at it, but I'm not gonna, yeah.
Yeah, gadolinium is the cleanest.
Yeah, gadolinium is definitely cleanest, which is also something I should have mentioned, actually, is for trivalent rare earths, gadolinium is an exception to all of this, because it has no orbital angular momentum, right.
In this Lankranos, you mentioned this electric quadrupole exchange term could act for the 1K rate. Okay? In this case, it's pretty dominating. What about, let's say, in the phase-space ground state? For instance, in this case, how this could be reflected from this generic anisotropic spin change model? Which term would reflect in that?
So you're asking how this maps to the anisotropic model.
Exactly.
Okay, so for anything but non-Kramers, so let's assume the crystal field energy scale is large. For a pseudospin or dipolar octopolar, this goes away. It goes to zero. So you can forget this. For non-Kramers, so what I've written here is only the nearest neighbor part. You can do this reasonably because it decays like 1/5. So it's fast enough where you can probably truncate it reasonably well. If you project this into a non-Kramers doublet, generically, what you'll get is contributions to these two interactions. So how they contribute depends on the composition of the crystal field doublet. But it'll contribute only to these, to the quadrupolar parts.
Let's see.
For whether your ground state doublet is gamma 4 or the gamma 5, 6,
yeah.
Is that irrespective of which doublet is the ground state? So are all the doublets of erbium that character, gamma 4?
No, so it's a mix. It's a mix, usually. You can actually work it out by just...
You need to know something about the detailed crystal field for a given material to know which...
Which is the ground state, yes. The counting you can work out just by looking at the states, because these have a certain character to them. They have to be connected to, plus or minus 3/2 modulo 3. will be a dipolar octapolar doublet. But yeah, the whether you get that as a ground state is a question. For certain ions, I think, so long as you're not too distorted from an idealized limit, you're usually okay, right? So for like the pyrochlores, you have this distorted cube of ligands, right? And so for a perfect cube, you know which doublet is the bottom, and if that's well separated, then this distortion, then you can guess. For some of them with closer space levels, it's sort of a detail-dependent thing, I think.
Other questions? So there's two important conclusions, right? One of them, at least two, that bare microscopic emission in terms of the angular momentum J being bilinear generically is not correct.
Right.
And the other one, the statement that holmium and dysprosiums are classical because they have a large J and a large magnetic moment is not really the physics, but really they don't have access to the required multiple.
Right, yeah. Spin, right? So this is something I put a tiny gray note to, but I think I forgot to say, which is... Sorry, it cuts these off on my screen, so I have to look at it up here. This one. So you're sort of primed to think that if your J is large, if your J is 8 or 15 half, this thing's going to be classical, right? You think large S limit, you think this. But this is only true when the rank of the interactions is much smaller than the size of the spin. So if this maximal rank is comparable to the size of the spin, it can be as quantum no matter how large the spin is.
How large the G is.
How large the total angular momentum is. Yes.
So can you imagine, the two examples you gave are the two examples that we talk about for the power force, the erbium 3 plus and ytterbium 3 plus. So is there another example? And those are both cases where the ground state multiplet is MJ equals a half, right?
Sorry, what was the...
So is there any other example?
Of a
system with quantum degrees of freedom, quantum effective spin a half degrees of freedom. Those are the only two that I know of, right?
Oh, the pseudo-spin.
Yeah.
Some of the spinels. So there are turbine spinels that have it.
Right, but it's...
Oh, you mean different rare...
Right, I guess my question is if you did the crystal field analysis, could you generate an effective spin a half from something that is other than having, its main basis state being MJ equals plus or minus a half?
Yeah, so plus minus 7 half is pseudo-spin.
It
just depends how much of that is mixed in with.
Okay, so you need the appropriate crystal field that would generate plus or minus 7 halves, right?
So, for example, you could have a crystal. I'm not saying this is realistic. I'm going to say this is patently not realistic. You could have a crystal field that would, for example, favor plus minus 7 half for ytterbium,
yes, right?
And then if that was very close to ideal, it would be almost ising, because that's again the rank 7 operator to connect them. So you'd have a very small G factor, but it wouldn't be zero. It would that would be sort of fine-tuned. So it doesn't have to be close to spin half, but it just has to transform under symmetry like spin half.
But
the
spinel case that you mentioned at the beginning, or maybe Michelle mentioned it. And so what is the crystal field ground state for that? Does it correspond to MJ equals plus or minus a half?
The change, right?
Yeah. So for example, for the ytterbium spinels, I think it's fairly close to, so the environment's octahedral, not a distorted cube, but it's actually pretty close to, it's much closer to a perfect octahedron than that is to a perfect cube. So you get something reasonably close to the cubic limit, which in this basis is actually a good mix of all three.
Nice.
Yeah. I think one of them dominates 80%, but it's not a clean separation of scales.
I was wondering about this. Do you know of cases where people actually measured the dispersion of sort of higher lying crystal field levels and found different exchange parameters than at other levels?
That's a very good question. So in terbium titanate, people have seen dispersions, but that's so low lying that it's probably not relevant for your question. I think you guys, And there's a measurement on erbium titanate where you guys seen some dispersion.
There's dispersion.
Yeah, in the higher line, in the first excited level.
F6MeV or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's really small compared to terbium is the extreme case.
Yeah. I don't know of anyone who's analyzed that in any way outside of.
Is the dispersion also small compared to the dispersion at low energies?
It's killed down by the gap.
Right, yeah, so you can really only see measurable dispersion in the first excited state.
I'm not sure.
Right, you don't see anything beyond that.
I'm not sure.
It's not because of resolution, because usually when you have a high energy...
Well, in principle, it is probably because of resolution, but it's also because of bandwidth, right? It's the combination of whatever the bandwidth is and resolution.
That actually brings up another point, which I should have said, actually, is one other feature of these multiple interactions. As someone asked about the electroquadrupole interactions, right? And so... I said that these project to zero for a Kramer's spin, right? But that doesn't mean for the higher lying levels they don't have some effect, right? So there can be an energy scale for these quadrupole or some of these even rank multiple interactions that's completely absent from the low energy effective model because it just projects to zero. And so there's sort of a hidden energy scale which we don't know in some of these systems that might appear in these higher levels as well. Again, reflecting the sort of mess sort of inherent in the fact that you have tens to hundreds of allowed couplings.
Okay, I think we'll end here. Vanessa, have some questions?
Okay, and so it's coffee break now, and we'll reconvene at 10:30.